everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season 4 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
And today we're recording in the La Trobe University City Campus Studios on unceded Bunurong and Wurundjeri land, and we are very excited to have our guest live in studio with us. Our guest's voice will be very familiar to you, especially if you live in Victoria, where Tamara O'Dine has been the ABC Television Nightly Newsreader since 2018. Tamara has also presented ABC Melbourne's Drive program, ABC News Breakfast, The World and Stateline. And prior to that, Tamara worked for the ABC's Asia Pacific News Service, and before that, she worked as a researcher and producer for commercial television factual programs in Brisbane and London. And apart from the fact that I have a long-standing girl crush on Tamara, along with most of the state, I suspect, there, now I've said it, Eve and I were very keen to have her on Archive Fever to discuss Tamara's latest project, an ABC podcast series called The Good Divorce, which Tamara wrote, produced, researched and presented. So we're getting very meta today with a podcast about the research process behind making a podcast. Tamara, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thank you so much to both of you for having me.
We've had a couple of journalists on the program now, and one of the things that's quite clear is that something that unites historians and journalists is this obsessive love of research. So you've had over 25 years' experience in the media industry. Can you recall when you were first bitten by the research bug?
I would say it goes right back to my childhood because I've always been interested in writing stories and reading stories. I was always a visual kid. I'm still a visual person. So I would watch 60 Minutes, see all of their investigations. I would watch Four Corners, had a bit of an unhealthy crush on Chris Masters for a while there as a teen, which is awkward. But I loved the way that these stories would unfurl and that they were told with pictures as well. So when it came time to writing my own stories as a kid, I would talk to people and interview them, ask them questions about what they were doing and spin it into a little yarn of my own. So I guess I've been researching in that way through talking to people for as long as I can remember, really.
So was research for you ever a paper-based business or is it always about talk? So you're kind of an organic journalist.
It was always about talk, but I think that's more a legacy of the fact that when I finished high school, the internet wasn't invented yet. So you had to actually get out and call people, tease ideas and stories out of them and get information from them that you could then synthesise down into a story that you could tell everybody else. When I was studying journalism at uni as well, online research wasn't that big a thing either. So we had to go to the actual library to research for assignments and research for stories. So I think that's maybe a bit of a hangover from that time, is that I'm most comfortable speaking to people when it comes to doing research for any sort of program that I'm working on.
Mm. So something that we've always asked people is, what does Archive Fever feel like to you, like when you're in the grip of it? And it strikes me listening to you that possibly Archive Fever feels different when you're talking to people than when you're alone in a library.
It does, because if you're trying to get to the nub of an issue and you're trying to find that right person who can give you the information that you need to hang your story or your program off, sometimes it can be a bit of a wild goose chase to track that person down. And the more people you talk to, the further away you get from where you need to be. Conversely, sometimes if you hit the jackpot with your talent, who will be able to give you all of that information and they can speak really well on air as well, that is just the moment that you know you've got something good.
And what does that feel like for you, that jackpot moment?
It's so intensely satisfying because you think, here is the person who is going to help me tell this story. You can have all of the facts that you want, but a broadcast story in particular, whether it be a 4-minute children's television piece or a 1-minute 20 news story for the 7 o'clock news, really hangs on the quality of your talent, not just from what they can tell you, but how they tell it as well.
And what makes good talent? Like, is it just someone who's very knowledgeable or articulate, or is there a kind of intangible extra quality that makes someone shine?
It's knowledge. Mm. To some degree, confidence, which is tricky because a lot of experts who you interview, particularly if it's in a research capacity, sometimes they're not really that au fait with the broadcast process. So being interviewed for a lot of people is really nerve-wracking experience, and I understand that. It's a matter of being able to make them feel comfortable enough to impart the knowledge that they have. So to some degree, confidence. Also, whether or not they can articulate what they're into. And enthusiasm's a big one. So I spent 4 years working as a researcher for the now defunct children's program Totally Wild, which was around for nearly 30 years. My overwhelming memory of speaking to all of these specialists in plants, animal research, sustainability, was that they were so enthusiastic. It was always a good news story, pretty much, that we were telling on that show. And you could hear it in someone's voice when you were doing the pre-interview on the phone with them that they would be brilliant talent because they were so into the research that they were conducting and really crazy excited about getting to talk to kids about it.
So is that one of the reasons that often when you're listening to the radio, you'll hear the same experts pop up over and over again? So journalists go back to the same source, to the same human archive in that sense, rather than expanding it. Because if you know you've got somebody who's good talent and can provide you with that enthusiasm and not a soundbite necessarily, but that mixture, that special sweet spot that you're talking about, you'll continually go back to the same source.
Sometimes, but I think you've got to be careful not to overwork that source. For example, if you're dealing with a particular issue, you would expect to hear from that person. And good producers and researchers are always trying to cultivate contacts and resources so that you can have a variety of voices, because like anything, the more people you can hear talking about it and bringing different viewpoints to the table, the better.
Yeah, I remember thinking that during the pandemic that there were like 3 epidemiologists,
yes,
who no one had ever heard of, and like they're all household names now. We can reel them off.
They
like
are.
This.
And see, but that's also indicative of that time. They were quite a comfort. I know that if I saw them on air or heard them on the radio, I would think, ah, here we are, I'm in a safe pair of hands. This person makes a lot of sense. They know their stuff. They have a soothing tone. All of those are the major ingredients that you need for good talent.
So as a newsreader, how much input do you get to have into the stories that make the nightly broadcast, and how much research gets put into backgrounding those stories?
We have at 8 o'clock every morning a conference call with myself, our producer for the program, our chief of staff, and some of the rounds reporters as well. And we come up in the morning with, well, what is the news of the day? How are we going to cover it? And because we're working for a television news bulletin, how will we colour that in with the pictures? So what are the picture opportunities? What case studies can we use to tell these stories? So that starts at 8 o'clock, then the journalists go off and do their news gathering through the day. We have another phone conference in the afternoon at 4 p.m, which is an all of network hookup between all of the metro news rooms, and we talk about what everybody's bringing to the table. So from our international desk, if we've got a story unfolding or a reporter on the ground in Ukraine, what they can offer for that day, what's happening in Canberra today or around the country if it's campaign trail, and what each metro newsroom will be contributing to the bulletin. And then from that point, the lineup producer and I work really well together, actually, in figuring out what are we leading with and trying to get flow through the entire program. It's important, particularly with news, there's not a lot of great news around in recent years, to try and have some light and shade. So we find something that can be a bit of a reprieve for our audience members at some point in the bulletin so that it's not all super heavy. Oftentimes it is, unfortunately. And then to answer your question about the research, I watch all of the stories where possible before they go to air. If I can't watch them, I'll read the script. If the script's not in, then I'll go to our online treatment so that I know exactly what viewers can expect to see and how I'm going to intro that story and invite them to react in a way, if that makes sense.
So the emotion that you're expecting is going to be invested in it in some kind of way.
Yeah, because look, to be honest, any bozo can read an auto cue, but to be able to tell the story as opposed to read the story is where the skill lies, I think.
Do you have a sense that the nightly news bulletin or the news that you're reading is going to become an archive for the future? I'm thinking of the film that Tosca Luby made, Strong Female Lead, that is cut entirely from archive about Julia Gillard's 3 years in office. And many of the pieces of archive that she uses is from the nightly news. Do you have that sense of posterity or the legacy that you're leaving, or is there just no time for that? It's just a 24/7 thing.
I don't on a daily basis, but when you've been through something as a collective that we all just have the past 2 years, 2020 and 2021, it becomes apparent when you're out the other side of it that, wow, what happened just there? It's almost like a visual time capsule. When we do a year in review at the end of each year for the news leading up to New Year's Eve, it's always fascinating to look back on the stories that punctuated the year. And our editors, our very skilled editors, will come up with a beautiful montage of all of the things that we've covered that year, and you watch it back and it's almost a little bit emotional because you think, wow, we really did go through some stuff, didn't we? And when you see the images of Victorians in particular really going through that grind of lockdown, I find that quite affecting. And so, yeah, it does feel like it is being stored in an archive of sorts.
As you've said, Tamara, we've been through some really heavy times in the last 2 years with COVID, the climate crisis, the war in Ukraine. Through your job, you're really at the coalface of those awful things. So I'm interested to ask about what that does to you at an emotional level. Is it hard not to kind of burn out or become cynical through your constant kind of immersion in the negativity of the world?
Sometimes, Eve, it is. During that time when much of Victoria was in lockdown, there were a very small core group of us who were still working in the newsroom. A lot of people were working from home or working remotely. Like a lot of people who were still classed as essential workers, it was a really unique time. So it was characterised by high degrees of anxiety and stress. And you might think, well, at least you had a job to go to. And that is absolutely a fair response to that. But everybody was operating in a rising tide in different vessels for those 2 years. So it was hard for everyone in different ways. I did feel the stress of COVID, but my job is not to show that. I'm not able to editorialise in my role as a news presenter. The best that I can do is try and connect with the audience through presenting with understanding of what's going on. And during that 2 years of lockdowns on and off, I got a lot of mail from people saying, hi, look, being locked at home meant that, you know, I could actually watch the news for the first time in a long time. And my family and I have a bit of a relationship with you, whether you like that or not, that's just how it is. So thanks for being there every night. So I took that idea into presenting the news each night. And there are always upsetting emotional stories, but it's not my role to show that in the moment or to get upset at the time. I'm reminded just now talking about this when, this is over 10 years ago now, when a chopper went down with three ABC crewmen on board and they sadly all passed away. I was filling in for Virginia Trioli on ABC News Breakfast the morning that all of that was unfolding. with the wonderful Michael Rowland as co-host. And we got into work at 4 a.m, which was our start time. It had broken overnight that the chopper had gone down. We were still yet to have it all confirmed. Michael was really upset because he knew all of those people. Our crew and team were really upset. And he and I had to have a bit of a pep talk with each other actually before we went on air to say, right, we have 3 hours on air. We're going to be talking about this. We'll be talking to the managing director. We'll be talking to investigators. How can we not drop our bundle? Because we can fall apart afterwards, but this story is not about us. So we decided that we had to think about all of the loved ones and the family and friends of all of these people, and out of respect to them, not get a wobbly bottom lip. Mm. I'll never forget, I'd sort of said to Michael, all right, well, I've heard somewhere that if you're speaking at a funeral and you feel like you're going to drop your bundle and cry, to just immediately put your thoughts and attention on the soles of your feet. It takes you out of your own head, puts the focus elsewhere. So I thought of my feet so many times during that 3 hour broadcast. And in fact, at one point, because we were playing all of these tributes with really sad music, and I said to Michael, I've got to take my shoes off. So I took them off and sat there barefoot. And mortifyingly, there was a wide shot that went to air of me with a little foot sticking out the side of the desk. And I was so devastated that on that day of all days, my foot went to air. But my then executive producer, Tim Aliff, was so great. He said, mate, whatever you had to do to get through that, I don't care if anyone saw your foot. If there's a complaint, tell them to come to me. That was a long-winded way of saying that in the moment, if things are really upsetting, I don't think you can drop your bundle. But I did snot cry all the way home and for the rest of that day afterwards.
And how in general do you process the emotions afterwards? Like, do you have any kind of rituals or, you know, friends you speak to as a kind of way to get these negative emotions out of your body and mind?
Through lockdown, it was very tempted just to drink a lot of wine, but that doesn't really help anybody. So I found that self-care was really important. And we did a lot of debriefing with trauma specialists actually in the newsroom afterwards, which was so valuable. Mm. And when they talk to you about self-care, they cover some pretty fairly obvious things, but sometimes if you're having a rough time, it's hard to access them. So eat really well. Mm. Try and sleep well. Talk about what's going on with a trusted other person. Let yourself sit in it for a bit. Don't just keep pushing on, because that's not really going to help anyone. And at least try and get outside. If you do have an hour available to you to go outside during lockdown and get some fresh air, do it. So it's so important to give yourself some exercise and give yourself a moment just to be able to process all of that stuff. And you can be really human about it and just have a good old cry. Mm-hmm.
Tamara, outside the work that you do in the daily news cycle, you've obviously also been interested in podcasting. And before I get on to The Good Divorce, you also produced and co-hosted another podcast series in 2017 called Streaming Inside Cult TV. The premise of this podcast was taking listeners behind the scenes on much-loved television drama programs and talking to the people who made them. Back to talking to people. Your first season of 14 episode peeled back the curtain on that first season of the Underbelly series. Mm-hmm. So clearly you've got an interest for methodology, for the process too, not just for the outcome, for the result. What led you to create Streaming?
Well, my very good friend Al and I, that was back in 2017, and there weren't a lot of podcasts happening then, not a flood.
Yeah, it's an early adopter. Yeah.
But we wanted to just see if we could do it. And he and I are mates, and we go back a fair way and have worked in the industry together. Al worked as a TV news editor, and I was working as a journo on the road in the court round while all of those underworld figures were going through the court system. So we sort of spitballed a little bit about, okay, well, what can our podcast be about? What have we got in common? Well, we've both worked in TV. We've both worked in TV around this time. And it was coming up to the 10-year anniversary of Underbelly going to air on Channel 9, which for people living in Melbourne at the time, that was huge. It was actually banned from going to air initially because of some ongoing court cases. So that's what got us started. And this was a 100% passion project. We were not getting paid for this. We borrowed a friend's studio. Al stumped up some cash for a recorder and we split it. And then we were like, okay, well, who can we talk to about this? Both of us work teaching television presentation at an acting school. And one of the actors who works there is Damien Walsh Howling, who was in Underbelly. So we thought, okay, well, we can start with Damo and do an interview with him about his character. And we got to a point where we thought, all right, let's do a episodic breakdown and then speak to one of the people involved in the program. So we were so interested in meeting the makers. We wanted to know about the art direction, who shot it, who directed it, who wrote it, what their processes were. We started the podcast with John Sylvester, the journalist who sort of kicked off a lot of the storytelling around Melbourne's underworld with his brilliant newspaper reporting on many of those figures. And in fact, the whole show was based on his writings from over the years. So we found it pretty tricky from the beginning to lock interviewees in, but it was almost like a domino effect. Once we'd locked in one actor, we'd go to another's agent and say, okay, well, we've got Damien Walsh Howling. Do you think Guyton Grantley would be interested, the man who played Carl Williams, in doing our podcast? And in the early weeks, it was, who are you guys? No, go away. But by the end of it, we had all of the main characters pretty much on the program.
Yeah, we get it. No, we've just had you on the show so that we can say, tomorrow, Dine did our podcast.
I don't know if that name dropping is going to get you too far.
We're Claire. Trying to get Lee Sales.
Yeah. I'll put in a good word for you. We were scratching around in the early weeks because we were wanting to make it really hard for ourselves and drop one episode a week. It was a really fun process. And by the end of it, we had Stuart Bateson, who is the detective who had arrested these guys and who was a consultant on the show in terms of their police practice and how they were choreographing all of their moves in the drama. So it was a really great experiment for the pair of us in how do we cobble something together quickly that's going to be engaging to listen to and relevant to at least some people.
So I assume that's going to provide some kind of backgrounding to then getting on to making The Good Divorce. Mm-hmm. So The Good Divorce first aired on Radio National's Life Matters program in early 2021. I've listened to the whole series a few times through now and I've got to say it's just terrific.
Thanks.
Just,
thanks for your ears.
My ears were glued to it. So the podcast turns on the idea that our main cultural image of divorce is as a time of rancor and bitterness and vast amounts of money spent on lawyers at 10 paces. Yeah. But that it is in fact possible to separate and co-parent amicably. It really is a terrific listen. It's informative. It's weirdly upbeat and entertaining even and a little bit voyeuristic, but also deeply sensitive to the nuances of what is a difficult topic, even I think a taboo topic. That's the end of a marriage is one of the most painful and traumatic and stressful life events, obviously. And you make no bones about the fact that you have been through a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
But what inspired you to turn your private life into a very public podcast?
A very good friend of mine, Maria Tickle, who is the producer of that podcast and needs a lot of praise for the brilliant work that she did on that. She and I have known each other for a number of years and she called me to catch up shortly after I had separated to say, hey, mate, what's going on? And I said, well, quite a bit as it happens. And she had also been through a divorce. So we were comparing war stories to some extent and lamenting the fact that there didn't seem to be a template for a better way of doing it. I mean, one in three couples or marriages ends up in divorce. So you would know someone who's either going through it right now or who has been through it or who is about to go through it. So it's a very common occurrence in our society today. And as you were saying, it's almost a little bit taboo. So I found even when I would tell people, say at the school gate, for example, I've separated from my husband, there seemed to almost be an element of shame to it as well, because there's a real sense of failure. My marriage has failed. And we wanted to make it a less traumatic experience for all people involved, particularly if you've got kids as part of the equation as well. So we started talking then and there about, well, there's a program in this of some description. She is a producer of some note at Radio National, and she was very keen on the idea of making a podcast, and she said, I want you to present it because you know you're going through it. I'm like, well, maybe give me 6 months or so because I'm really treading water madly here just trying to survive. And she started then pitching it to Radio National, and it took a number of years before it stuck. And even then, we kind of had to do it in our own time. And I'm glad for that time that passed because it meant that I could actually process what I was going through myself and figure out what was fair for me to share. So, yes, it is an intensely personal project, but I was very mindful of not overstepping the mark because a divorce is between two people. I let my ex know that I was doing it, but at the same time reassured him that I wouldn't be speaking for both of us at all because that would not be fair. And I have two sons who are quite young, so it needed to be something that I could produce that they could hear, whether now or in years to come, and I wouldn't feel would be damaging in any way.
So you don't have to answer this, but was your own divorce cordial or was it garden variety wretched?
I don't think that you could ever describe having a divorce as a fun process. It wasn't fun, as 99% of them aren't. It wasn't at the terrible end of the scale either, but it did occur to me, as it does to many people going through it, surely there's got to be a better way to do this. And that's really at the core of why Maria and I went about making The Good Divorce. Is it even possible, was the question. The follow-up question to that is, well, how?
Mm. Is divorce something that has been well documented? So I'm thinking now about how you researched this. Because of the kind of taboo nature and because of the shame that's associated with it and because, as you say, that the language is my marriage has failed, so it's already been posited as something that is
really negative.
Negative and should be underground. I mean, we're only just starting to talk about domestic violence and other things that happen in homes that are supposed to be private and also are not pleasant. But is divorce something that you found has been in any way well documented?
To some extent, yes. And when you're starting a project like that, the first place that you need to start is finding the experts to talk to. So finding the people who will have data around an event like family breakdown. Where does it happen? Why does it happen? When does it happen in a relationship? Is the experience heightened by global pandemic? Short answer, hell yeah. And that's the data that we were trying to drill down into. And finding the experts who could talk to that was a vital starting point for that podcast. So we spoke to people from Relationships Australia. We spoke to people who are at the coalface, family lawyers who see this stuff playing out in the courts constantly and could see the tsunami of divorces that was about to crash during the lockdowns.
And the podcast also includes people who have been divorced and have done it well. How did you go about finding those case studies?
That was tricky. I put the call out on Twitter telling everybody what I was doing and what we were looking for, and we got some fabulous case studies that way. And a program like this really sort of lives or dies by the quality of the case studies. We need people who can tell us their story. Also, because it is about divorce, their exes need to be okay with it too. So it's not just getting the green light from the person who it happened to, it's the other people who it affects as well, and how will their family and friends and children feel about hearing it. So online sort of crowdsourcing was one aspect. We also spoke to family lawyers, counsellors, whether or not they knew people who might be able to participate. We wanted to have a very representative pool of interview talent as well. So we didn't want to hear just from women. Women are more likely to open up and talk about this stuff than men. But it was really important to us to have male voices on that podcast too, so that it could be useful to everybody. And we didn't want just straight relationships either. We wanted queer marriages and with kids preferably. So how do you disentangle yourself in that kind of situation? Given that gay marriage in Australia is fairly recent, there's not a lot of divorce data around queer families. We were lucky enough, though, to be able to find a family who were happy to talk to us. But we did find that quite often we'd get to, say, the day before an interview after locking somebody in who had a great story to tell, who would have been quite inspirational for our listening audience in terms of how they managed it. And the day before, they'd call us and say, oh, I've actually had a bit more of a think about this and I'm not really comfortable with it. And you have to respect that because it's a very personal thing to share and they are juggling in the background other people's feelings as well that they have to accommodate. So we had to say goodbye to a lot of talent, unfortunately, and really work to get the trust and rapport with the people who we did interview. And they were so brilliant and brave for talking to us so openly about their own experience. And all of them did it because they wanted the best for other people who were going through that experience as well. So it was a really selfless thing for all of them to do in the end.
Tamara, Eve and I are both children of divorced parents. And I guess one of the things that we know and we've talked about from our own experience and maybe also instinctively as historians is that the effects of traumatic events can play out over many years, if not generations.
Absolutely.
Do you have any intention to return to the scene of the crime and to do follow-up interviews in, say, 5 or 10 or 20 years with some of those participants who you've worked so hard to get and see whether the best laid plans of those good divorces have gone awry?
That would be the dream, to be able to do that, to get the funding and be able to do it. So I'm going to say yes, I would love that to happen. I'm a child of divorced parents as well, but my parents divorced 5 years ago after 43 years of marriage. So divorce isn't just something that happens to people in the infancy of their marriage or when they have very small children. It can happen after a very, very long time. But yeah, I would love to revisit both the people who were divorced, but also importantly their children, to see the impact that it's actually had on them. For the podcast, we spoke to a wonderful child psychologist called Dr. Vincent Papaleo, who had some fascinating insights through his work in the family court. And honestly, what that guy sees on a day-to-day basis is heartbreaking. How kids get dragged through very traumatic breakups and the lasting impact that it has on them. So kids who are privy to a very traumatic marriage breakdown are more likely to suffer later on in their life when it comes to mental health issues, addiction, and forming relationships of their own. If you are going through a marriage breakdown and you do have children, it's so important to keep them front of brain because they're like sponges. They can absolutely soak up any tension whatsoever, not just in harsh words that are spoken, but body language. They can see tensed shoulders. They can see a set jaw. They can hear a tone of voice and know that there's tension here, and they absolutely soak all of that up. So you need to be so careful and on guard all the time to make sure that they're not hearing any of that stuff.
Which is also why it'd be so interesting to follow up with the kids of people who have gone through what they consider to be good divorces.
Yes. To we see did whether talk to some kids about good divorces who have grown up and say, you know, the best thing my parents did when they divorced was we would have birthday dinners all around the table together. Or my best memory from childhood after my parents divorced was we all went on a holiday together. Now, that's not going to be possible for everybody, obviously. That's sort of the gold standard. But they will always remember when you can pony up and be adults and nice to each other.
One of the kind of core tenets, I suppose, of journalism is objectivity. But I imagine it might have been tricky to be objective about a subject matter that is kind of inherently so emotive and divisive, but it was also something that you had personally experienced. So what was your kind of relationship to the subject matter of The Good Divorce as you're making it?
I was out the other end of my divorce by the time we were putting this together, but there are a lot of things that you can retrospectively enact through speaking to experts like this. And it's important to remember that even though your relationship with your ex has broken down, you're not out of a relationship with them, particularly if you're parents. Mm. You have to co-parent well together and raise these kids who you've produced and leave them not feeling traumatized by the experience. So I think I was able to be objective in this way because we were listening to lots of different voices about what works. And you can kind of bowerbird it a little bit and collect all of the bits of advice and information that you can apply to your own life, I think. And I think that it helped having been through a divorce myself in terms of how to frame questions, not just for our experts on that subject matter, but also other people who'd been through it. So it's a sensitive topic. It's important to approach it sensitively and not ask anything that's going to be upsetting to somebody, yet being able to push it to the point where you are getting useful and helpful information from somebody. So, well, I was aiming to be as objective as possible, but I think my own lived experience helped with being able to do that because I know, well, that's a bridge too far. If somebody at the school gate had asked me that, I would have been really miffed. Mm. So being able to take that knowledge into it was vital.
Mm. So it made you a better journalist, really, to have that personal experience.
I think so in that particular case, yes. And when you're talking to somebody who's been through the mill, it's always helpful knowing that the person asking you questions has an idea of what you're going through. It makes you more likely to open up. It makes you more likely to trust that they're going to do right by you in packaging up the entire program. And we ended up with something that both Maria and I were really proud of.
And what has the reception to it been like? Did it really resonate with listeners?
It really did. Mm. I received a lot of private messages on Twitter, emails from people who were keen to share their stories if we happened to do another season, which we would love to do, just saying. But also people saying, look, I've not really talked about this with anyone before, but I've been combing my local library for books that could help me and I've not found what I needed until this podcast. So thank you for talking about this stuff because there was a real gap in terms of that information. Because as you were saying, Claire, at the outset of this conversation, there's such a negative vibe to divorce that it's really hard to fossick through the wreckage and find something positive and helpful and useful. So, yeah, we got a lot of mail from people, particularly from men, actually, saying that that was a good listen. And so I've jotted down all of their names saying, please be involved in the second series if we do it.
It strikes me that it'd be really important to keep hold of all the letters and feedback that you've had and create a kind of good divorce archive for future historians. Because when I think about research that I've done into divorce historically, say what was going on the goldfields or, you know, in other periods of history, the only thing that you really can find is when divorces have wound up in court. Mm. And then there are court reports in newspapers. So already acrimony is at the heart of it. I mean, that's also partly because of the legal structure. No-fault divorce has changed all of that. You don't have to go to court to do it. So in the days when, you know, you had to find that reason, there had to be adultery, there had to be desertion. So court was part of it. So court archives are where you go. But it strikes me that if you were trying to research whether there have been good divorces in the past, you're probably unlikely to find sources for it.
That's true because a lot of it's hearsay. So that's why it was so important for us to speak to specialists in the field like marriage counsellors, for example, who might be able to point us in the right direction of somebody who's managed it really well. Because you're right, it's not logged anywhere. There's not a lot of data on who has managed to pull a good divorce off. And look, it's more common than you might think from the conversations that we had with people. And that's a really heartening fact, and that's something that I really took away from doing that podcast, is that those stories are out there. You just have to try and find them.
So in terms of this idea of kind of creating your own archive from the ground up, a kind of good divorce archive, it strikes me as well that the period of time that you were recording this, as you've said before, during a pandemic where divorce rates are potentially skyrocketing because of the particular tension that families and households have been under, do you feel like now looking back that your podcast is a kind of a time capsule of an era?
It absolutely is. It's still relevant now, even though we were recording it through 2020, because there are still relationships that are only now finally fracturing because of the pressure that they were under for the 2 years of in and out lockdowns. And it very much is a snapshot of our time, but I'm hoping that it's evergreen content that will be able to still be used in the years to come.
I was really intrigued to hear you say, Tamara, in the final episode, in your sort of acknowledgement section, if this was a book, it would be your acknowledgements. You say that The Good Divorce was, and I'm quoting, many years in the making with a lot of grit and hustle required. It's unusual to find people admitting to the hustle that's required to get most research projects up. Mm. So what did the hustle look like to you and Maria?
Maria was working from home, so we weren't ever in the same space when we made this podcast. Once it was all done and dusted, we were allowed to go out for a drink together because lockdown had finished. So the hustle looked like Maria on top of her day job at Radio National, madly firing off emails, calling people, trying to convince them to be part of this podcast, doing many hours of pre-interviews, because the first time you hear these people on the podcast isn't the first time we've spoken to them. You've got to vet them for being good talent, but also figure out what information that they can bring so that then you can plan out what your episodes are going to be and how to script them, because we're scripting them based on the facts that we're gathering. So there was a lot of story gathering and talent gathering. So that's what that hustle looks like. We spoke to Catherine Woodward Thomas, who came up with the idea of conscious uncoupling. She's an American writer and therapist. So even just the time difference meant trying to lock her in was a constant hustle for Maria. Then, of course, you've got all of the pre-interviews. So that's many hours of phone conversations. Then when we're talking to people to try and share their stories with us, there's a lot of trust building that needs to happen there too. So not just, oh, great, you can talk to us about your divorce. Excellent. Speak to you at 11 o'clock on Wednesday. It's having a series of conversations with those people, finding out what their experiences are, finding out what they're comfortable in sharing, and allaying any fears that they might have, which are all, you know, absolutely par for the course and fair enough, about sharing those stories. So there's a lot of massaging that needs to go on before you even get to turn the microphone on.
And you also mentioned that there were years of trying to convince Radio National to take it on. What was their hesitancy?
I actually don't know the answer to that. We would pitch whenever there'd be a call out for new ideas for programs. We would go through that whole pitch process. Maybe it's because of the bad rap divorce has. Maybe it was a bit of, oh, no one wants to hear about that. But I think once the pandemic hit, you could not argue with the stress that that was putting on not just individuals but couples, but also the stats. The stats that we were getting from divorce lawyers meant that their business was increasing to some incredible extent. They were anticipating this tsunami of phone calls and approaches. Even websites where people would go to investigate the idea of divorce, you know, the first port of call for people who are starting to chew that over, were seeing this incredible, incredible influx of traffic. So it got to the point where you couldn't really argue with it not being an issue. It was very much a live issue in Australia and worldwide. Divorces in China had spiked after their huge and major lockdown that the world was watching from a distance, and in the UK as well. So it was something that was being observed the world over.
The final question, Tamara, is something we ask all our interviewees here on Archive Fever. Do you have a dirty little archive secret that you'd be willing to share with us?
Let's see how this one goes. When I was a court reporter, I don't do shorthand, so I would take meticulous notes in court. When you're doing court reporting, you have to get it word for word correct. And you're covering a number of different cases at once. And as I mentioned earlier, there were a lot of underworld cases happening. We were covering really grisly, horrible stories that would go over months and months. So I took to colour coding my notebooks. Not the colour of the notebooks, but the colour of the ink. And I am such a stationery nerd that
I knew we'd get there.
Was ribbed mercilessly for my books. And you've got to keep all of your notebooks for a requisite number of years when you're doing that kind of reporting. And I found them recently and they fill me with so much joy, even though it's pretty dark, the content in each of those books, because I could flick to anything that was in black ink and know that that was underworld. I could go into anything in green and know that that was county court. I could go into anything in blue and know that that was an ongoing murder case. So dorky as it sounds, bringing order to that kind of chaos in my work life was something that I took great pleasure in. And my best friend still ribs me about it to this day.
You see, we can sense a nerd
anywhere.
The sign of a true
archive
nerd. We'd get there somewhere.
Don't even get me started on my colour-coded bookcase, because that's also a little bit OCD.
Tamara, it's been an absolute delight to have you on Archive Fever today. We really thank you for coming along and sharing all that you have with us. It's been a real treat.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you both.
If you haven't already heard The Good Divorce, obviously you will all want to start listening to it immediately. So you can jump on to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can follow Tamara on Twitter at Tamara O'Dine, and you could follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, and 3 via the website archivefeverpod.com. as well as our bonus episodes from Sydney Writers Festival and Adelaide Writers Week. And our theme music is from Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded today on unceded Bunurong and Wurundjeri land and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. Coming up on the next episode.
People who feel like these institutions have information about their lives that they should have, but is being protected in these kind of sanctuaries, and you have to go through all these protocols to access these sort of spaces. And the archivists who work in these spaces, and potentially historians and others, have seen information about these people's lives that they don't know themselves. Mm-hmm.